You've got addiction, you've got a very powerful industry. It still manages to get around advertising restrictions. Think of the industry as a sort of multi-headed hydra. So every time you block off one route, the industry will pop up somewhere else.
Welcome to Message Recall, a podcast series exploring the history, tactics and psychology of advertising in public spaces. I'm Tommy Siobhan.
And I'm Anna Mears. And our recall journey starts with the tobacco industry.
What cigarette do you smoke, Doctor?
I never smoked nothing else. Just practicing, Mr. Flintstone.
Change your cigarette.
So have you ever seen the old cigarette ads, the Marlboro ads featuring racing cars, the Lucky Strike physician recommending a healthy smoke, Rab C. Nesbitt and the mild cigar, even the character Lambert and his witty butler on billboards advertising cigarettes here in the UK.
So we're like talking about vintage adverts for cigarettes.
I can sort of remember some of the adverts on like billboards, bit of print about 80s, 90s, I guess.
Okay, so this is pretty vintage then we're talking about.
Okay, yeah, so I guess I'm starting to be a bit vintage, yeah. So I've been noticing e-cigarette campaigns that are incredibly reminiscent of cigarette adverts from the past. These adverts contain images that align vaping products with youth, lifestyle and health, targeting their new products to young non-smokers that are being introduced to slick nicotine-based products.
Rather than to adult smokers that are trying to quit, it's like a new generation of consumers.
Exactly. And we're now seeing some of the famous old players like Philip Morris and British American Tobacco updating very well-trodden territory, like backing Formula One racing, for example, but with new branding that is vague, really vague.
This is winnowing, and this is our mission.
So like Mission Winnow, a mercurial platform that states on its website that it drives change by constantly searching for better ways of doing things, which seems to coalesce around the funding, research, engineering and racing industries.
Yeah, or like Better Tomorrow, which is a technology and innovation partnership between McLaren, Applied Technologies and British American Tobacco.
So there's a disconnect between what's being presented as the organisational aims and the products, the cigarettes, that built the partnered or funded parent company.
Yeah, and more than that, in the case of the Philip Morris company, they've invested in the Smoke-Free Future programme, run by them.
So, by funding anti-smoking programmes and declaring that they're stopping cigarette sales, they are evolving into more health-conscious, responsible organisations? Isn't that a good thing? I mean, it's difficult for them to deny that cigarettes are not harmful anymore, so they sort of have to.
Yeah, but when we dig a little bit deeper and consider the other less overt branches of their production lines, then there are big questions regarding what these companies are actually doing.
Yeah, so going back to the Philip Morris International website and the British American Tobacco website, it's hard to know if they even sell tobacco anymore.
Same with Altria, Japanese Tobacco and Imperial. When you go on their websites, it's as if they're sort of like future tech humanitarian conservationists.
Who is looking into whether we can actually trust these companies?
My name's Andy Roll. I am the Director of Tobacco Tactics at the Tobacco Control Research Group at the University of Bath,
which is the academic partner in the Stop Global Watchdog on the Tobacco Industry. As a journalist, Andy has been writing on the tobacco industry for over 20 years.
The problem with the industry has is over one in two of its long-term users die. And so it has to replenish and it has to replace those dying smokers. And that's where advertising comes into it. There's a great quote from an ex-advertising guru, and he said that the problem is, how do you sell death?
This is a quote from Fritz Gargan, a former marketing consultant for five tobacco companies who recognised that their target consumers are young people.
So no images of brown teeth, orange fingers and sexy chronic illnesses was ever going to sell cigarettes.
You know, if you think of Marlboro, you think of the iconic, you know, Marlboro man, rugged, outdoory symbolism of masculinity. Or you do it with Joe Camel, who was like a cartoon figure that studies showed that children as young as three could recognise Joe Camel. And it's now reusing many of the tricks it used for decades on tobacco on its new generation of products.
Now, we're based in Bristol, and Bristol is the home of the Imperial Brands headquarters. Big tobacco is such a huge subject, so we wanted to see how much had changed over the past 60 years in Bristol, let alone the UK.
Bristol was the home of Wills Tobacco, which was an incredibly successful cigarette producer, and at one point they had the biggest tobacco factory in Europe.
WD and H.O. Wills, makers of...
Wills was one of the many British tobacco companies that were part of Imperial, until Imperial withdrew the Wills brand in the 80s.
While trying to search some of the tobacco history in Bristol, I came across a website called Bedminster Tobacco Women and contacted Helen.
My name is Helen Thomas and I grew up in Bristol.
Helen eventually moved to Cardiff, where she became interested in local history, particularly women's history in the coal industry.
Women's history as part of the industrial and economic development of any country has tended to be overlooked.
Helen then moved back to Bristol and was aware that there was little written about the Wills tobacco factories, where in the early 20th century, many women worked making cigarettes.
I thought, I wonder if anybody's written up a history of Wills.
And they hadn't, so Helen and a couple of friends wrote a book together.
Called Bedminster's Tobacco Women.
Focusing on the lives of people, especially women working in tobacco factories.
You can still see a lot of the old red brick buildings around Bedminster. One of them is now an enormous Asda.
It was a huge and major employer.
The company goes all the way back to the 18th century and is named after W.D. and H.O. Wills, who took over the business when their father died. Incidentally, neither of them smoked.
One of the big reasons why Wills started to be so popular was because of the First World War.
They were supplying cigarettes to the British forces in France in vast quantities because it was a kind of, sweets almost. People needed their tobacco.
So remember when Andy was speaking about the heads of the Hydra at the beginning of the programme?
Every time you block off one route, the industry will pop up somewhere else.
Now, this is a great metaphor for the industry. There are so many heads of this beast that we don't actually have enough time to cover them all. But one major example is how tobacco, in particular cigarettes, have a long history as a form of currency. For example, in Victorian workhouses, where tobacco was rationed out as a treat, it enabled people in power to have control. And to some extent, we can see that today in prisons.
We spoke to Helen about her research and lived experience of the tobacco industry, or the Hydra.
I'd worked for Wills for two summer holidays when I was a schoolgirl in the embassy coupon department of Wills.
Embassy cigarettes had a coupon in the packets that you could collect and exchange for garden furniture and domestic appliances chosen from the embassy catalogue. A washing machine would be 49,000 coupons.
Wow, that is a load of coupons. It sounds a little bit like an Argos catalogue.
Basically, yeah. It's one of the earliest reward schemes with cigarettes.
And it was a deliberate attempt to claw back their market position because Wills hadn't modernised their brands for a long time and they were losing out. Wills just needed a new brand to get the consumer's attention back.
That's mad. To incentivise binge smoking, some sort of way of upgrading your domestic appliances.
And my sister's mother-in-law actually smoked enough to get a Kenwood mixer, which she must have smoked an awful lot for quite a few years.
It's actually bananas.
I wanted to get a picture of how smoking culture started to change when the scientific studies began to emerge that smoking was irrefutably bad for health.
When I was a teenager in the 60s, everybody smoked. Smoking was common currency. When you went to the cinema, the adverts before a film were mostly for cigarettes and alcohol, and cigarette companies were advertising on racing cars, on cricket matches, on sporting events of all kinds.
There were advertising campaigns to try and make smoking part of that transition from being a young child to a young adult to sort of showing rebellion against your parents. So even now, you know, for young kids when they're growing up, there is still decades of advertising sort of weight behind that sort of transition, where young kids think part of me growing up is I go out drinking and I start smoking. we are dealing with a highly addictive drug. Once they've been persuaded to start, you know, they are addicted to this product.
I've been reading a book called Ending the Tobacco Holocaust by Michael Rabinoff, and I came across this quotation by a cancer specialist doctor called Tom Osden, who spent 30 years working for Philip Morris. Apparently in 1969, he said, "Whatever the individual's intent, the act of smoking remains a symbolic declaration of personal identity," and continued to say that as the force from the psychological symbolism subsides, the pharmacological effects takes over to sustain the habit.
That's pretty chilling to hear from Philip Morris's own vice president of science that even in 1969, they knew that their messaging segued so powerfully into physiological addiction.
Which is why they had to make cigarettes seem so cool.
For the industry, you know, cigarettes are very cheap to make. It's a very profitable industry. You've got addicted consumers and you've got a cheap product.
I remember going to the GP in the late 70s, and the GP was happily smoking Benson and Hedges in his surgery when you went in to see him. People are saying they're not very good for you, but they're still advertising them. I still can buy them. You can still smoke in pubs and on buses and stuff. And so I think it took a long, long time for people to take it seriously.
I grew up in a world where the tobacco industry had successfully created a cultural normalness around cigarette smoking.
That's Dr. Angela Raffel, honorary senior lecturer in social and community medicine at the Bristol Medical School, who has been involved in the smoke-free campaign which helped push the government's ambition for England to be smoke-free by 2030.
There was adverts on television all the time. I remember it being very glamorous. You could buy little packets of chocolate branded Chesterfield cigarettes in the sweet shop, which created that subliminal brand recognition for little children. And you were just surrounded by it. It was completely normal and aspirational. Early in the 20th century, lung cancer death rates in men started to go up really dramatically. They thought it might be traffic fumes, and they really had no idea because people had had tobacco, but what they hadn't had was mass-produced cigarettes. It was 1948 when Richard Dole and Bradford Hill published their now very famous case control study of men with lung cancer, which showed that smoking was a really strong factor associated with having lung cancer. And at the time, they both smoked. Dole smoked untipped. Bradford Hill smoked a pipe. 98% of social class men smoked. The royal family smoked. It was such a universal thing, people hadn't thought it could be the cigarettes.
So I'm getting a sense of the broader context here. World War II had recently ended, and during the Blitz, you had cigarettes being presented as something that calms nerves.
And rationing continued in the UK until 1954, so the market for aspirational goods must have been as hungry as ever on the ground.
So we asked Angela what the turning point within the scientific community was.
In the 1950s, the Medical Research Council said to the government, "Look, this is absolutely definite. Smoking is causing the lung cancer epidemic."
When a press conference was held, the health minister deliberately chain-smoked throughout.
One Harley Street physician was prominently quoted as saying, "This is a most unscientific claim. They'll be blaming mother's milk next." What had happened was behind the scenes, the tobacco industries had got together, even though they competed for market share. By 1954... they'd banded together and created a front group called the Tobacco Industry Research Council, which was their platform for spreading confusion, fake science, misinformation, because they knew that the research showing it caused significant health damage, they knew it was real.
And then as the years went by, it transpired that it wasn't even just lung cancer. It was many lung diseases, peripheral vascular disease, heart disease. It made strokes more likely.
They realised they needed a multi-pronged approach, so they needed to dispute the science, produce fake science. They needed to pretend that they were actually solving the problem. They were making filter cigarettes, they were making light cigarettes. They had to portray anybody who cared about health as a really extreme zealot.
So surely this scientific evidence at least challenged the myth of good health and vitality. What did medical professionals on the ground make of this?
When I was a medical student doctors in white coats smoked in hospital corridors in front of patients. You were allowed to smoke in the medical school corridor if you were a graduate, so it was seen as a sign of privilege. Universities accepted research funding from tobacco industries without even questioning it. And it took a lot of really solid, careful campaigning to shift those attitudes. By the 1980s, if a university took tobacco money, that led to serious questions.
Today, it's hard to even fathom doctors and practitioners smoking inside hospitals because we associate smoking so definitively with endangerment. So how and when was the myth that smoking was somehow a good and healthy lifestyle choice finally decollated?
Advertising had been banned on television in 1965, radio 1971. Billboards and newspapers wasn't till 2003. The lung cancer death rates in men were going down, and in women it was starting to peak. Though lung cancer was still high for women, it overtook breast cancer in 1999. And you never hear of lung cancer as talked of as a women's health issue. You only hear about breast cancer and cervix cancer and stuff like that. As the number of people actually taking up smoking and continuing smoking started to dwindle, then the health damage from secondhand smoke came to the fore. 4,000 chemicals in the smoke you breathe out, 70 of them are card-carrying carcinogens. And the damage, particularly to little lungs, to babies, was impossible to ignore.
To discover evidence that smoking harms babies and children must have been a pretty huge bombshell. I mean, if you know that the activity you're encouraging parents to engage in irrefutably kills and harms their children...
And this totally transgresses the 1991 UNHCR Rights of the Child, Article 21, which states that every child has the right to the best possible health.
And the tobacco industry knew this was coming, so they'd been framing this as about you can't segregate smokers from non-smokers. And so we had to make the debate be nothing to do with smokers. It was entirely about the smoke and where it happened. And we had to frame it as this is about health and safety at work, especially for people in the hospitality industry.
OK, so the debate moved away from the smoker. I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me that this became a really uncomfortable place for the government ethically. If the role of the government is to protect its citizens, and then evidence emerges that that activity that they've supported as legal for such a long time is unhealthy and potentially lethal to those around them... The individual has a right to engage in that activity, but those around them have the right not to suffer due to that choice.
At the time, there were some powerful stats in regards to death from occupational exposure. So for firefighters, it was this. Construction workers, it was this. But for hospitality workers, it was way, way bigger because they're breathing carcinogenic secondhand smoke.
Gradually, we managed to show, by doing very careful surveys, that almost everybody was bothered by secondhand smoke, and almost everybody was too polite to mention it, and almost everybody thought that other people weren't bothered by it. And that was because the tobacco industry had been able to control the narrative.
Even heavy smokers were reacting positively.
Die-hard smokers who say they don't care about damaging other people's health was a tiny, tiny percentage of the population.
So what were the first steps in the smoke-free campaign?
So then Liverpool, as a city, took a really brave and courageous step. They started to try and bring in legislation at city level to enable them to have more smoke-free workplaces, and they put a lot of money into that. And that was very powerful. And then Bristol, we created a smoke-free charter in 2005, a five-year charter to work towards smoke-free, all the things we could do. And to our surprise, the city council signed up for it straight away, which was all credit to the team who'd been working on it, really, because Bristol is home to Imperial Tobacco. It's where the Wills factory was. We've got a long tradition of smoking in our city's history. The core cities, They all clubbed together, and the tobacco industry was very skillful at persuading everybody it would be too complicated. You couldn't define an indoor space. It was a long, hard battle with a lot of freedom of information requests, one of which was to ask how many people had responded on the government consultation, which the government was trying to hide. Once they see how it's just the same as them enforcing food hygiene. It's about protecting the public, and it's particularly about protecting babies and children. Then the campaign became a huge success, and there was a year to build compliance before we actually went smoke-free. We were really glad that Ireland went first, and culture changed overnight.
So that was a huge cultural shift and a massive win against the tobacco industry. And around the same time in 2005, the WHO implemented the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which is an international treaty trying to oversee the activity of the tobacco industry. And included in that treaty was Article 5.3, which was designed to try and protect public health from the activities and lobbying of the tobacco industry. Basically, it excludes the tobacco industry from having any influence on public health policy.
When that came into force after the millennium, the industry increasingly found its voice being excluded from the table. And at the same time, it was increasingly excluded from advertising in traditional formats through, you know, more and more regulation.
And I guess at that time, it would seem that the tobacco industry was just getting weaker and weaker. But then...
Enjoy is an electronic cigarette. So what you're seeing coming from the device is not smoke, it's vapor. I can smoke this anywhere. On the airplane, I can smoke it in the CES show, in government buildings, and I can still enjoy my nicotine.
They've had their own versions of e-cigarettes, you know, sitting in their labs for decades. They've had versions of heated tobacco for years, and they've never really marketed them. But now they've kind of seized on this moment. A, they're sort of fighting back against, you know, the independent e-cigarette companies. But also, the more they can be seen as pushing forward e-cigarettes, it's more difficult to sort of exclude them either from Formula One or other types of advertising, because they turn around and say, well, actually, we weren't allowed to advertise because that was tobacco, but we're no longer tobacco. We are now an e-cigarette.
So they're using the technological disruption that's happening within the industry to try and get back to the policy table and to get back to advertising on any platform they want to.
You read their sort of analyst reports, and they're saying to analysts, this is great because smoke-free areas and smoke-free legislation was restricting our consumer moments, is what they put in their briefings. But actually now, with a combination of e-cigarettes, heated tobacco, maybe smokeless tobacco and cigarettes, we can regain those consumer moments and keep people completely addicted 24 hours a day.
So it's like the Hydra is back, full force, all heads blazed, and you got a whole load of new, young, potential consumers. Now, over the decades, we've seen many of the traditional print and media routes to target young people cut off, and suddenly come the internet, you've got a whole explosion of unregulated space.
If you're the tobacco industry and your problem is that one in two of your long-term users die, you cannot afford not to be on Instagram or not to be on TikTok, because, you know, these are the most influential advertising platforms there are right now.
And now, even with COVID-19, seriously, this tobacco industry knows no bounds.
You know, this is an industry that just loves crisis. We've got COVID-19. Hey, you know, let's use that as a marketing opportunity.
So Andy had been investigating the activities of big tobacco companies on social media, and he found that British American Tobacco was using a hashtag last year, Today I Will, to market Glow, one of their Vype products.
And then when COVID came along, they changed their hashtag Today I Will to Today I Will Stay Home. And that branded content suddenly started appearing on their branded face masks and as hashtags in Instagram posts.
Is it just me, or is it perversely ironic to utilise the stunned attention of the public during a pandemic caused by a respiratory virus to then sell vape products?
Yeah, it's Orwellian.
It was also putting out COVID-19 hashtags for Vype. For example, in Spain, it was using the Spanish equivalent of, quote, flatten the curve to also promote its Vype products.
And then when people searched for government messages, they would come across the Vype posts. The same in Latin America and other parts of Europe. Both Glow and Vype were advertising and marketing their products in this way.
In March 2020, Forbes ran a story on how Philip Morris donated 50 ventilators to a Greek hospital.
And this is what Slavoj Žižek would regard as the perverted logic of cultural capitalism, where the seeming discordance is smoothed over or offset by charitable activities.
If you're looking at influencers on Instagram, is this branded? Is this non-branded? Are the hashtags they're using, are they official? Are they not official? The hashtags will move, the platforms will move, the influencers will move. You know, it's confusing.
With seeming impunity, have there been any moderation measures?
You know, Facebook and Instagram, they've come out with a policy, but it's fine words, but no action. We've seen no cases where they have actually taken content down because it violates their new policy. You know, they've done nothing.
BAT, building a better tomorrow.
So remember Better Tomorrow from the start of the programme, the technology and innovation partnership between McLaren Applied Technologies and British American Tobacco.
And Mission Winnow, the funding, research, engineering and Formula One sponsor that's associated with Philip Morris Tobacco.
You know, if you've banned tobacco companies from advertising its products or its cigarettes in Formula One, then the company's going to think of a way of getting around it. BAT, if it's using something like a Better Tomorrow, that was originally designed to promote its e-cigarette. So they'll start using it, saying, hey, these are just e-cigarettes, this isn't tobacco. But now it's rebranded the whole company.
So by definition, they're basically advertising cigarettes again. And Mission Winnow?
They're trying to get round the rules. They're sort of saying Mission Winnow is about how we are transforming as a company, what we believe in the way we work to enable a better future. We're sort of saying, actually, no, this is just another way that they're trying to circumvent these advertising bans and get their logos and their branding back into a sport that they've been excluded from.
And after all the work through the past 50, 60 years in the UK and globally to ensure that tobacco companies have no influence on our health policies, it would seem contrary to suggest that these companies have any sincere concern over the health of their current or potential consumers of their products.
Until Philip Morris's smoke-free campaign.
You know, Philip Morris could just stop making cigarettes tomorrow. Simple. In the West, they're trying to sell you products that the jury is still out on whether they're any less harmful. And in developing countries, they are still up to all their old tricks, trying to push cigarettes to youth, delay legislation, bully governments, you know, and it's same old nasty big tobacco. This is all about trying to make money, keep people in a life of essentially dual use of, you know, cigarettes and new products.
The tobacco industry has simply re-emerged and identified itself away from cigarettes and back into the consciousness of those trying to give up smoking, but marketing itself to young, aspirational non-smokers. Taking this product away now seems a paternal action of the state, withdrawing the freedom away from the individual again. So it seems in some ways we've gone backwards.
The legal global tobacco market estimated in 2018 that tobacco sales were worth $814 billion. In 2019, the WHO reported that an estimated 8 million people died worldwide from tobacco use. It's also good to point out that Philip Morris, that started funding the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World in 2017, released a new high-tar, high-nicotine cigarette brand called Bold in Indonesia in 2019.
Yep, it's business as usual in countries like Jordan, Africa and Indonesia, where they are marketing and selling cigarettes to young people because there are far fewer regulations.
Dubious health credentials aside, I also asked Andy about his thoughts regarding Big Tobacco's funding of certain foundations and charitable organisations which they celebrate on their websites.
One of the dangers of this kind of money, sort of philanthropy coming from a tobacco company, is that you'll get, and this will happen in organisations in the arts and it will also happen within the scientific community, is you'll have some people who are prepared to take the money because there's no other funding, and then some people who will oppose it on a matter of principle. What happens is by default, or potentially also by intention, is that, you know, this money divides the community that it's receiving it. If you split the opposition you know, you can rule them. That is in their industry documents. It's in recent leaked PMI documents, how they were really setting out to divide the opposition, because a divided, fractured opposition is much easier to counter and also to control.
So potential beneficiaries operating in a funding deficient context have to decide whether they'll be supported by and associated with tobacco,
and potentially jeopardise their own socially responsible credentials and relationships with anti-tobacco communities, as well as other socially conscious businesses. I also wondered what Angela's views were in regards to the tobacco industry's own smoke-free initiatives.
I stopped working in the sphere of smoking in 2009. And actually, when the coalition government came in, they dismantled most of the really good campaigning. It worries me that Philip Morris are pushing the we're going to be smoke-free to kind of divert attention from the fact that we're not actually being very robust in our efforts to support everybody to properly go smoke-free. There's less support to stop smoking services than there used to be. If we really step back and think about what we've learned in the last 40, 50 years, we've learned a huge amount about how much our mind can make us miserable with its addictive patterns. It feels like there's these movements going in opposite directions. On the one hand, a lot of people are learning about the value of slowing down, connecting with nature, giving, being part of your local community. And it's almost like the big multinational corporations know that's happening. So they're even more desperate than ever that we can never escape their constant clickbait, you know, feel miserable, buy something to try and make yourself feel better.
We've just had this kind of iconic moment of Black Lives Matter and sort of talking about companies that had their roots in slavery and what this means right now. And tobacco was an inherent part of the slave trade. And actually, if we are looking forward now in this century and saying we don't want these colonial, imperial companies dictating addiction and health inequality on our lives, then they should have no place in our future.
In Bristol, June 2020 will be remembered for the toppling of the Colston statue. The Royal African Company, which Edward Colston was involved in between 1680 and 1692, was responsible for the transporting and trading of thousands of African people that were sold as indentured labour to work on tobacco plantations. The debate about toppling the statue had been ongoing since the 1990s, and the crowd who attended the June 2020 Black Lives Matter march actively determined Colston as a profiteering racist deemed unfit to be memorialised as a part of history.
So, there's a huge wind of change, and perhaps the tobacco industry's greatest challenge will be the active, consolidated and united determining actions of us, the public.
So a big thank you to contributors Helen Thomas, Angela Raffel and Andy Rowell. There are fantastic free resources for more information regarding the tobacco industry, which have helped us massively for this programme. TobaccoTactics.org, Ash.org.uk, Tobacco Control from BMJ Journals, TobaccoFreeKids.org, TobaccoBook.com, where I came across the book mentioned in the podcast, Ending the Tobacco Holocaust by Dr. Michael Rabinoff. And for more information on Will's Tobacco Factory, please check out Bedminster Tobacco Women by Helen Thomas, Rosie Thomason and Mavis Suchi. This episode was brought to you by the Message Recall team, including hosts Anna Mears and myself, Tommy Chavan. Researched and produced by Callum Sims, Morgan Tipping, Kaylee Jackson-Baker and myself. Sound design from Peter Dodd. And the Message Recall music was produced by Mishima. We've had huge support from Robbie Gillett, Nicola Round and Lee Coghill. Please check out Adblock and Adfree Cities and subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from.
We're working with our friends Adblock Bristol and Adfree Cities. Here's Lee Coghill, who's been working with Adblock Bristol for around 1.5 years and has done lots of work against planning applications for new holdings, in particular digital billboards.
Hi, my name's Lee. I'm a volunteer with Adblock Bristol, who are trying to stop corporate advertising from taking up space in our public spaces in the city. And we're part of the Ad-Free Cities Network. So we're groups all over the country of people who feel the same way, that actually corporate messaging isn't welcome on our streets and we could do better. Our website is adfreecities.org.uk, and on there you'll find loads of information about the groups that we've got all over the country, resources on why advertising is particularly bad and what you can do about it. And if you're feeling inspired to do something, take action against the advertising that's outside in your city, then get in touch.